Okay, welcome. This is one of my first talks in a general group, and as I was sitting, you know, I was noticing that I was nervous. And, you know, one of the teachings that was really nice, and one of the reasons that I sit, is that I can be aware of emotions, I can be aware of fears or insecurities or whatever, and I have an opportunity to be more observant around them and not let those emotions take me over. So the Buddha talked about the four foundations of mindfulness. And what he said was, be aware of the body in the body. And as I was sitting tonight, I was just sort of doing a little scan, and it's like noticing where there was just tension in my body. And I got to see how I hold tension up here, and then there was some tension here. And I could just breathe into that. And then the next feeling, the next mindfulness practice is know the feelings in the feelings. And it's like, is this a positive feeling, a neutral feeling, or a negative feeling? And it was sort of like, you know, there were some positive feelings, there were actually some negative feelings, and I could just be aware. And then the third foundation of mindfulness is know the mind for the mind. And so I was able to just look and say, you know, on a basic level, it's like, okay, there's nervousness there. And then there's also excitement and there's curiosity. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is know the mind objects as mind objects. And I sort of take that as, what are the stories that I tell myself? And, you know, in this case, it's like, have I prepared enough? Have I over-prepared? Am I going to stutter? Am I going to forget the Four Noble Truths? Am I, you know, and so there's just this litany. And I got to watch these little mind objects arise and then pass away. And that's one of the gifts that I have from practicing Buddhism and practicing meditation, is that I can watch these sensations and these feelings. They come up, they make a statement, and then they pass. And now I can choose to water any of those little stories that rise up and make them really, really big. And then my whole world gets consumed by this story. But all it is a story. It's a fabrication that I make up. And I get to watch that. So that's a quick teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness. And if you practice the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha said, if you practice them diligently for 7 years, you will reach liberation. And then he goes on and he goes, no, actually, if you practice it for 6 years, you will reach liberation. And then he goes down, 5 years, 4 years. No, if you practice it for a month, you will reach liberation. And then 2 weeks. And then he finally ends at 7 days. If you practice this mindfully for 7 days, you will reach liberation. So all of you, if you practice diligently, by next week, you can be free from suffering. And freedom from suffering is why I practice, and the desire to be free from suffering. And when I suggested at the beginning setting in an intention for the sit, one of my intentions is that I don't want to create suffering or cause suffering for myself or other people. And it motivates me in my sitting to be more diligent. And I look at suffering. Suffering for me, the definition of it has evolved as I've read more about Buddhism, and also as I've tried to get a grasp on it for myself, because for me to practice to be free from suffering is really huge. You know, that's a big concept for me, and it's hard for me to understand. But if I practice a suffering that includes really minor things, it's sort of like as we were sitting, you know, I don't know if any of you had any knee pain or aches, discomfort, you know, negative thoughts, you know, all those are aspects of suffering, sort of like a dis-ease or discontent, you know, and that discontent is included in that suffering, and I want to be free from that. And I don't know how to do it by myself. So one of the things I do is I started working with a teacher. Initially I started coming to Spirit Rock Meditation Center and I sat. And when I would go home, I started sitting for about 20 minutes. And my goal when I sat for 20 minutes was that I wouldn't have to say a negative thing about myself for 20 minutes. And at 21 minutes, free to say whatever I wanted. Bad meditation, I don't know how to meditate. Whatever I wanted to say, I was free to say. But for those 20 minutes, I didn't have to say that, and it was a break. And that was my introduction into a more formalized practice. It's really, really simple. And for me, I need to be really, really simple. Because the talk tonight is about the six character types or six roots of, in some ways, our behavior. And they're fun roots. They're sort of like personality types. You know, what type of personality are we? And there's sort of a mix of character types. And I happen to be, as I look at it in some ways, there's one that's, it's the confused speculative type. And I tend to be more of the confused speculative type. And what that type does is he gathers lots and lots of information. And then once I have all my information, then I look at something else and it's like, oh, I need to get information about that. So I gather lots and lots of information. So as I was preparing this talk, I had lots and lots of information. And, you know, so that's the confused part gathers it and then doesn't know what to do with it. And then the speculative part gathers it and then sort of narrows down what's important and starts to streamline and get rid of the stuff that isn't needed. The other four types are, we have the craving type, and that's, the craving, which is similar to the three roots where we have desire, hatred, and ignorance. And with the six roots, the character roots, we have it's craving, which is basically desire. Hatred and confusion are the first three, and they're the unwholesome roots. And then the other three are faith, intelligence, and speculation. And they sort of pair up. So the craver, if you look at it at a spectrum, on one end, the really bad is the craver, and at the other end is the faith type person. And the thing they have in common is that they desire things. And the craver desires whatever he or she can get a hold of. Good, bad, whatever. Just give me generally unwholesome stuff. Whereas the faith type person craves really positive and wholesome things. The hatred and the intelligent both don't like things. So they're sort of, they push things away. They're aversive type people. And the hatred you can see with, you know, anger, aversion, and the intelligent, they push away things because they see that they are not healthy for them, that they don't want them. So an intelligent person will sit there and go, walking in front of a truck is a bad idea. Won't do it. The craving person may actually walk in front of that truck if they see something on the other side that they really, really want. So they will end up stepping in front and getting run over because they're not looking at that truck. Or maybe they want the truck and they get run over. And so those are the types. And in the teachings, when this was first presented, it was presented primarily for Buddhist teachers to sort of ascertain what type meditation practices would be good for the different types. You know, you have a craving type and they are attracted to beauty, to really nice things, and so they would have meditation objects that would actually get rid of those would challenge that beauty. So a lot of the cravers, one of the meditation techniques would be to do a study on foulness and decay. And there's actually a list of, I think there's like 9 or 10 meditations just on, you know, on the body and the, you know, where you would study a corpse and you would watch it. And, you know, one that can be used right now is like, I assume nobody here smokes cigarettes or anything like that. But a technique would be with nicotine or with drugs, it's like there's a craving that goes in, there's an addiction. And as you're smoking, a meditation technique could be, as you're bringing the smoke in, you envision the smoke turning your lungs black, you know, beginning to decay them, having the cancer begin to grow. And then as you smoke, you probably won't really savor that cigarette very much. And that's how you sort of turn away from the craving. And we could do a meditation like that, but I thought I'd bring in more, another practice is one of generosity. And I will tell a story of Kuan Yin, who's one of my favorite bodhisattvas. And Kuan Yin, this is one version. It's one of the Chinese versions, and it's actually, from my understanding, based on a somewhat real story of a Chinese princess. And she was the eldest daughter of three daughters of this lesser king. And the king, as she was getting older, you know, was hoping to marry her off, but she was into generosity. She was just a very open-hearted, caring, wise person, and she wanted to reach enlightenment. She wanted to leave suffering behind. And she didn't want to get married. She wanted to walk the holy life. And so this king was just like furious. It's like, no, you need to get married. And she goes, well, I will get married if you can tell me, three things that will not happen to people. And so the king goes, okay, well, what are they? She goes, well, the first one is tell me that people will not get, you know, that the young will not get old. You know, can you show me that happening? And he goes, no. She goes, can you show me of a healthy person who will not get sick? And he goes, he couldn't do it. And she goes, well, can you tell me of someone who will not die, who will enter the deathless? And he was sort of irked at those questions and just said, okay, fine, go to your monastery. And she went off to the monastery, and he contacted the nuns and said, I want you to make her life so hard that she will want to come back to the palace and get married. And the nuns were all pretty scared of this king because he was a pretty mean guy. And they gave her like the hardest jobs, and she's working and working, and she had to go get water from the creek, which was, you know, a mile down the road, and the land that she was tilling, she also had to carry the water and till that. And she had so much generosity and compassion that in the kitchen, all of a sudden, a spring just burst forth, so she didn't need to go down to the river anymore. And then the crops that she was working on, they just grew year round. And just like beautiful big, you know, zucchinis and pumpkins and all sorts of things. And the king heard about this and he got really mad. It's like, this is not cool. This is not going the way I want. So he sent his bad guys to go and kill all the nuns and drag the princess back. And the princess, she ended up leaving. And she went to another monastery, and the king's henchmen killed all the nuns. And about a couple years later, the king got really sick, and he had gangrene, and he was about ready to die. And a monk came in and said, I can heal you, but what you need is you need the eyes of a noble person. And the eyes and arms, actually. And there is such a person that in your kingdom that can help you. So the king goes, okay, go and find out, and went to the princess. And and told the princess, and she goes, "He is my father, and I love him very much, and even though he's misguided, perhaps by my giving him my eyes and my arms, it will help him see the errors of his way." So she sacrificed her eyes and arms. And the monk went and made his little mixture, and the king was cured, and he just thanked the monk. He goes, thank you, here, have some jewels. And the monk goes, "You should thank the one who gave you her eyes and arms." And then the monk vanished. And so the king didn't know who it was and went to the monastery where this person was. And as he was walking up, he saw his daughter and realized that his daughter was the one who had sacrificed his eyes and his arms. And he just broke down and wept. And he understood the suffering that he caused. And he was, he moved along the path of towards liberation. And what strikes me about that story is the complete generosity of someone. And I think about it, and as I was thinking about that story, I thought about it in present times. It's like, how can we be generous? And they have donor, there's old donor cards for my license, and I've actually marked that, but I've never thought of, well, if I'm living, I'm not real willing to give a body part if I'm alive. If I'm dead, I really don't care that much. But I thought about it, and it's like, if a friend of mine had told me that he had kidney problems and needed a kidney, my first thought would be, it's like, well, I hope you find a donor. It wouldn't be here, let's see if my blood type's the same as yours. I wouldn't even think of that. And with generosity, one of the main elements of what is a truly generous act is being able to give something 100% freely, without condition. And when I can't give my kidney, I can't give an eye, because I think I'd probably regret that later on. And so how do I start developing practices that can actually get me to the point where I see my eye as something that's not that important to myself, but where I see the interconnection between all of us, and then I can give it freely? It's like, I don't start off giving body parts away. I start off with something really simple. I give a carrot to somebody. I see a homeless person and I give them, 50 cents or a meal. When I work with, or when I'm around homeless people, it's actually one of my hardest practices. Because when I give a dollar to a homeless person, I've noticed that I'll look away. I'll give it to them and it's like, hope they, move on. It's like, I've done my good deed, and it's like, thank you very much. And I've realized that when I do that, I'm not planting seeds of generosity, because I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed and I'm uncomfortable. And so those are the seeds that I'm watering by my action when I give that dollar. So now when I do give that dollar, I think about it beforehand. And it's like, this person is a human being who is struggling. I am a human being who is struggling. So I look for the connection and the commonality. And then when I give him a dollar or her, I can see that person as my brother and sister. I can see that person and I can open up my heart to them. And so there are times when I don't feel I can do that. If I'm really uncomfortable and I'm walking down the street, I won't give them anything. Because in some ways it's trying to show them love and respect. And I don't want to disrespect anyone in this world. And you have a question?
Oh, I was just curious why you would feel embarrassed to give them money. What was that embarrassment about?
For me, it's, I have stuff and that person doesn't,
And I think I sort of did.
Yeah.
I go through this.
Yeah, so there's, all of us have like various reasons. And, look at a way of checking your generosity, and it's like when you've done a generous act or when you've told someone you've done a generous act, which generally is I'll start over. You know, when I do a generous act, and then a few minutes or a few days later, I regret being as generous, or it's like, you know, I shouldn't have done that. It's like, then it's not as, it really isn't, that's where my edge is of generosity. And I will tend to pull back, and it's like, okay, I don't know if I want to be that generous next time. Because I don't want to, every action we do has a consequence. And so, when I do what I think is a generous act, and then I regret it later, there are other things going on. It's like maybe I felt obligated, but I didn't, you know, didn't recognize it. So I go back to the act, and I just ask myself, I sort of run through some questions. It's like, what was impelling me to do what I did? And I do it in a way that's not judgmental. It's a way of being curious. You know, with all these practices, it's real important not to be judgmental. Oh, that was bad. That was stupid. Be curious. When we explore all this stuff, be curious, because it's a way of getting rid of our suffering. It's not a way of increasing our suffering. There are four types in one of the scriptures. There are four types of people in the world. And one torments himself or herself. One torments herself and others, and one torments others, and then one neither torments himself or others and leads a holy life. And, you know, naturally I think that I never torment anyone. But, you know, when I look at that, it's like, you know, I fit somewhere in those first three categories, probably most of the time in some ways. You know, from my banter with friends to, you know, using fossil fuels. It's like there's a big realm. And how do I cut back on that tormenting? And a lot of it is being aware of my actions and being mindful. And actually, there's a quote that I want to give you. I heard this from, it's Ajahn Tenisaru Bhikkhu, who I believe is going to be here either next week or the week after. He's coming in 2 weeks. Yeah, he's coming up soon. He's talking about the present moment and what is being mindful. Because what is being mindful is being aware of your actions and the standards of what counts as good action or a bad one in terms of the results they bring, keeping watch on your intentions, noticing and being able to change. And for me, that encapsulates the whole practice. You know, I set my intention, and then I do an action, and that action causes a result. Now, is it a positive result or is it a negative result? If it's a negative result, you know, hopefully I won't do it again. I do a lot of negative results over and over again. And it's the result of habit. It's the result of my mindlessness. It's like after the first couple times that I do something, you know, I'm watering those seeds, and it's either a seed of craving, aversion, or confusion. You know, I'm watering, I'm reinforcing those. And the only way to break that is by being aware of my actions and being aware of my intentions. I love the phrase, it's like the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And, you know, the road to enlightenment is paved with good intentions also. The key is, what are our actions? What is our mindfulness around it? What is our awareness? And there are so many times where I am aware that I shut down my awareness because I just don't want to deal. And I make excuses like, you know, I've been practicing a lot. I need a break. During something that's come up a lot for me recently is when I've been on meditation retreats. A meditation retreat will, you know, let's say a 7-day retreat, it basically you wake up in the morning, you do a 45-minute meditation sit, then you do a 45-minute walk, and then 45-minute sit, walk, eat a couple times a day, and then walk, sit. And a lot of things happen in walking and sitting. And, you know, when I would get up after a meditation sit, you know, instead of walking, I would go, because I deserved my cup of tea, and I would go have my cup of tea. And I missed out on a lot of the walking meditations because, you know, I need a little break. And then all of a sudden that 5-minute tea break would be, you know, 35 minutes. And then I'd walk back so I could sit. And which is not recommended for walking meditation. And, you know, I've thought about that a lot. It's like how I do that practice. And the mindfulness practice that we use when we sit is the beginning of the practice. So after the bell rings, you know, a lot of people sit there and, you know, relax, move their legs and stuff. It's like when you do that, once you break one of the sitting style or sitting periods, and something I'm working on more now is to let that state of mind that I've developed while sitting spread through the rest of my period. So sort of right now, it's like, you know, tap into your own mindfulness. You know, tap into your awareness of how you're sitting, how you're being present right now. And even go so far as like, you know, spend about, or use about 20% of your awareness to focus on what I'm saying. And use the rest of your awareness to just be in your body. You know, be in your breath. You know, center into your belly. And notice if there's a change. You know, you can even close your eyes for a second. And notice if you feel more grounded when you do that. And one of the things that sort of surprised me the first time I did that is that I didn't need to put 100% of my attention on what someone was saying. But if I actually kept the majority of my attention on my own, knowing my body as my body, my feelings as my feelings, I was a lot more aware. You know, I could engage a lot better with people. I was more focused. I was more concentrated. And that's the gift of mindfulness, is having that, is being given that awareness. And we can develop it in isolation, sort of, when we do our meditation, the formal meditations. But it's designed to be carried in our day-to-day lives, in our day-to-day activities. And the standard, I sort of look at when I go off on meditation retreat, I set a standard of stillness that I want to try and maintain and continue to develop when I'm in the world, when I'm in with the busyness. So the sits are the beginning of our meditation, of our mindfulness practice. It's in our daily lives that we really carry this. You know, and so I was thinking about the six roots, and you know, the first one is craving. And then to finish up a little bit about that is, you know, the two types of craving are grasping and clinging. And what I like about that phrase of grasping and clinging is like the grasping is, you know, I'm reaching out. It's like, oh, if only I got this, if only I had this, my life would be better. And the clinging is I have this and I can't let it go. You know, my life will be over if I let this go. And in the teachings, you know, everything is impermanent. You know, there's the realization, it's like we look at our lives and it's like, how much have we, you know, even 10 years ago, what do you have today that you had 10 years ago? You know, you've definitely lost a couple years of age. You know, everything in your pocket, the odds are there's not one thing in your pocket that you had 10 years ago. You may not even have the same wallet. You know, what about the friends that have grown in your life that were just your best friends? You know, some of those may still be around. Some of them, probably not. We grow apart, we grow together. We grow apart, we grow together. You know, and that's one of the beauties, the rhythm of the life that we live. And it's inevitable, you know, things change. So as I grasp or as I cling, you know, I will never be successful. You know, and I can never truly enjoy something that I'm holding on to so tightly. Because, you know, sort of like the clenched fist. If it's inside this fist, I can't even see it. But if I open the fist up, you know, it can fly away, it can hang out, but I can enjoy it, even for that moment. And that's, so as we develop and start looking at, you know, the character type that clings or grasps, you know, the practice is to let go. It's why generosity, faith is the opposite part of that. And as we develop generosity, we begin to develop faith. And what faith is in the Buddhist teachings is it's like a rational faith. It's based on my faith in Buddhism is based on what I've seen other people do. So I can read all the scriptures and all that stuff, and they're nice and great. But I look at some of my teachers, and I see the attitude that they have. And I see that they have that attitude because of their practice. So my faith is based on a rational... My faith is based on my observing their behavior. And that if I do the same things or do similar things, I can attain that also. And so when things start happening to me, for example, when I first started sitting after a month or two, I remember that I really, there was a self-confidence that came up in me that I did not expect. You know, and part of it was being consistent in sitting every day. And part of it was giving myself a break of not beating myself up for that period. And then part of it was just this exploration of meditation. And what that gave me was self-confidence that I didn't have, and a deeper respect for the teachings. And that inspired me to continue teaching. I mean, to continue the study and the practice. And so that faith is like, I can reach liberation. I can be free from suffering. I can, for me, it's like, I can cause a lot less anguish amongst my friends, enemies, and myself. And that's sort of how I look at it. And over the years, I've caused, you know, a lot less, I don't say as many stupid things as I used to say. You know, I am kinder to people than I used to be. And it's not that I wasn't a kind person before, but what's nice now is that I'm aware of generous actions. And I want to keep doing generous actions. And that feeds on the past actions that I did. And so that faith sort of keeps driving me to do more. And also, when I am not involved, or I, you know, I can read about, I talked about the four foundations of mindfulness and becoming totally free from suffering. It's like, I'm not there yet, but I have faith that I can get there, you know, by just showing up and being as diligent as I can. I think the other part of the roots that I want to talk about is the hatred and the intelligent part. You know, I'd like to talk a lot about the confused discursive, but I, you know, it's funny when I was looking at that, is I was getting confused trying to figure out how to talk about it. And I look at my life and I think, you know, some of the ways that the confused person will act is, you know, as I said before, the gathering of information. And then not being able to commit to things. And there's a model that, a spiritual assessment model that talks about, you know, actually breaks down these these roots, and the confused type in this model is the meaning and direction type person. And what that means is like they're very, very open to all sorts of information. And what's good about them, and one of their strong suits, is that they're not tied into any views. So we can be talking and I can make a statement and you'll say, you know, that's totally wrong. You know, what you said is totally wrong. And I'll sit there and think about it. It's like, oh, you know, you're right. And then go on. And I won't feel bad or stupid or anything like that. It's just sort of like, oh, yeah, I'm wrong. So I'm not vested in a view, which is really powerful for moving towards, you know, the end of suffering, because, you know, if I'm narrow in my view of suffering, then if I know that I'm wrong, I don't have to defend that position. It's like, oh, okay, let's go this way. Oh, let's go this way. The downside to that is, let's go this way, you know, and then I just sort of, you know, meander all over the place. That's the confused. You know, it falls into the delusion, and you know the three roots is it's the ignorance. Greed, hate, and delusion. Greed, hate, ignorance. You know, that's pretty much in that area. I actually like the word ignorance a lot better, because for me, ignorance is not knowing better. You know, being stupid is doing something over and over again. I actually heard a new definition of stupid is doing the same thing over and over again. And the way I first heard it was doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And then I heard a definition where it's doing the same thing over and over again, but knowing the result that's going to happen. And it's like, I've been there. But ignorant is not knowing the result. It's like all our behaviors, and this is, I think, one of the most beautiful things about the teachings, is that ignorance underlies everything we do. We don't know better. You know, I don't know that when I get insecure and I'm financially insecure and I take money from someone, I really don't know that that's going to hurt someone. More importantly, I really don't know that that's going to hurt myself. You know, I think that's actually helping myself. I can't see the connection that, or the chain of events that is going to begin to happen by my doing that wrong action. You know, I can't see it. And that's where ignorance is it's where we can be gentle with ourselves, you know, because we don't know. We don't know about our fears and our insecurities in so many ways. And they're so deep. They're so deep inside us that we don't know. One of the aspects and one of the benefits of doing a sitting practice is that that's where we can actually begin to see how we react to certain things. It's like when I sit and there's a discomfort in my knee, you know, initially when I first started sitting, my first impulse is to move. You know, it's even unconscious. I move. You know, the leg moves. Now when I'm sitting and I'm being mindful, I ask myself why. You know, I explore the uncomfortability. I explore both here and the knee, know the body as the body. I know the feeling. It's pleasant. If it's pleasant, I don't move it. If it's unpleasant, I move it. So I don't move it. It stays unpleasant. I get to watch it pass. And then I study the mind and how the mind will tell stories. If I don't move my knee soon, you know, my foot's going to fall off. And then this whole story comes off. And if I don't have a foot, it's like, you know, everyone's going to laugh at me and I won't be able to drive. And so the stories start. So when we sit, we can watch those in a safe environment, because that chattering mind that I experience as I sit, I experience every second of the day. and I don't recognize it because I've put layers. It's like I'm watching this or I'm driving here. I've got the music on. I'm multitasking all the time. When I sit, I'm not. And all of a sudden, my mind is sort of left exposed and I can see how the thing works. And it's scary sometimes. It's like, oh, man. And it will remain scary for the rest of my life, which is cool. Keeps things interesting. One of the last part, I was concerned that I wouldn't have time, and I need more time. But so I want to talk about hatred and intelligence as the other two roots, and the development. Hatred is anger. Aversion, aversion is a good way. It's like the pushing away, and the intelligent. We want to work towards an intelligent character type. What an intelligent character type is, both of those are. One of the characteristics is they can be in your face. People who are in your face, and what's nice about them is you can come right back to them in their face. It's really easy to be a truth teller to someone who's an intelligent type. Because what they will do is, like, if you call them on something, they'll look at it, they'll make an assessment, and they'll go, you're right. So they're quick, in some ways they're quick to change if they are presented with the evidence. If they're not presented with the evidence, it's probably a bit harder to change. And the hatred types will push everything away. It's like, don't like this, don't like that, don't like that, get away. And one of the practices to change that behavior is loving kindness practice. And all these practices also is we do them so that we can end suffering, our own suffering. And it's something that I need to remember whenever I do my studying. It's like, why am I doing this? Why am I sitting? It's to end my suffering and end my causing suffering to other people. It's to end my discomfort. Dukkha has lots of, it's a hard word to translate, which, suffering, the suffering aspect. There is suffering, there are the causes of suffering. There's the end of suffering and the path to the end of suffering. And that suffering, I've heard it called stress, discomfort, dis-ease. And so that's what I'm trying to end in my life with this practice. That's what I'm trying to end. And I need to practice with curiosity. And loving kindness is when I'm aversive about something, when I'm hateful, it's a great practice. Not to discount the anger, because there's a place for anger. All our emotions are here for a reason. So there are no bad emotions. But if I want to develop a more open-hearted lifestyle, loving kindness practice is a great practice. And there's a story of an abbot, and he had four monks with him, and he was up in the mountains above this village, and he was practicing loving kindness and just practicing it for months and years on end, and all the other monks were somewhat practicing with him. And he had, his best friend was one of the monks. This lazy, slothful person was, who just irritated him to no end, was one of the monks, another monk. And then there was a really old monk who was about ready to die, and a sick monk that folks didn't know they didn't know if he was going to get better or if he was going to die tomorrow. So these five monks are out practicing in the mountain above this village, and some robbers came up, and they saw this place as a great hideaway for themselves. And they went up to the abbot and said, "You need to leave. We're taking over your monastery. We're going to rob and pillage and have a good time here, and we've decided that we're going to let you go, but we're going to kill one of your monks and just so you know, not to tell anyone about where, you know, about what happened. But we want you to pick which one of the monks we should kill. And so the abbot had, you know, five choices. You know, best friend, the slothful person, the sick person, and the really old person. Now, which monk do you think that the abbot picked? Okay. A lot of himself. Okay. Why?
Generosity.
Generosity, okay. His practice of loving kindness. Okay. Any other reasons?
And the suffering of making decisions.
And the suffering of making decisions. That's a confused type answer. Like, okay. Actually, the confused type says, there's no problem here. Okay. Any other people have any choices? None of you would get rid of the guy that irritates you? Okay. Okay. Wrong. The abbot wasn't able to make a decision because he'd been practicing loving kindness for so long that there was no difference between him and anyone else. And it's the cornerstone of loving kindness or metta practice is when you start it, we start with ourselves. If you don't start with yourself, you create a very powerful imbalance, especially if you're doing loving kindness with a difficult person. The monk was not able to because he was the same as his best friend. He was the same as the worst, his difficult person. He was the same as the old man, and he was the same as the sick. So there is no way that he can make that decision. And when we open our hearts up, we open it to it includes ourselves. And it's usually the first one we forget. It's like, oh, I will be the generous one to sacrifice. You know, I am the caring one. And, you know, that's a really beautiful attribute. But it also can be used to create martyrdom. And so when we practice metta, as we start with ourselves, and there are four, actually I will give you the 12 reasons. Now the 11 advantages of doing metta. One sleeps happy. One wakes happy. One dreams no evil dreams. One is liked and loved by all human beings. One is liked and loved by all non-human beings too. Bees, you know, you won't get eaten by tigers. You won't get, you know, bitten by snakes. None of that stuff. One is guarded and protected by the divine devas, little angel types in Buddhist tradition. You cannot be harmed by fire, poison, or weapons. And you swiftly attain concentration of the absorptions. And so there are lots of benefits. You know, I really like the part where you don't get eaten by lions and stuff like that. And the practice is a really, really simple one. It's, may I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be free from suffering. May I be healthy. And as we do metta, it's like sometimes people will do that at the beginning of a sit or even at the end. And it's just sort of like as we can do those phrases right now, and it's just sort of, you know, be in a comfortable position and take a couple deep breaths and just gently close your eyes. May I be peaceful. And let it just flow. Flow through your body. May I be happy. May I be healthy. be free from suffering. And so we have a few minutes for questions if anyone has a question or a comment.
I have a question about character types.
Okay.
Isn't everyone like a combination of all those different things, and can that change over time, or can that change like day to day? Like one day you wake up and you're experiencing hatred, the next day, you know, you're more of an intelligent person. I'm just wondering if everybody is kind of a mix of all those different things.
The way I do it is like 1 minute I'm hateful, 30 seconds later I'm, you know, moving more towards intelligent. Yeah, so it changes. You know, the extremes, odds are none of us here are in those extremes. We're a mix. We're a mix of the ones. What helps me is that the hatred and the craving are pretty easy. You know, I know when I'm in craving mode or hatred mode. Confused mode, I'm pretty sure about that. I'm not 100% though. And when I look at that and I notice, like, you know, I'm craving right now, it's like then I can go, it's like, okay, well, I can look at it. It's sort of nice to, for me, to have like a little bit of a label to sit there and go, oh, this is, I'm doing this, I'm grabbing this because I have desire for it. And is this a healthy desire or is it an unhealthy desire? You know, some unhealthy desires, I will sit there and notice that I have desire and then I won't ask any more questions because, you know, then I'd have to be honest with myself. So the process is being is to recognize it, and then ideally it's like, you know, what, there's a phrase, forsake the lesser pleasure for the greater pleasure. And the first time I heard that, it's like I loved it because, you know, I go for immediate gratification at times. And if I sit there and it's like, is that the pleasure that I really want? You know, immediate gratification, I take it, a few minutes later, it's gone. You know, if I don't take it, you know, then I'm developing a greater pleasure, you know, developing an equanimity, a peaceful center. But if I'm always grasping whatever feels good at the moment, you know, it's really anxious, you know. It's not that comfortable in the long run. It may appease things right at this second, but in the long term, it just tires me out. Am I willing to forsake the immediate pleasure, the lesser pleasure, for the greater pleasure? So yeah, there's lots of difference. You know, our character grows and evolves, and we try. Part of the practice is watering the good characteristics. And if we water those, they're the ones that will flourish. You know, if we water the bad characteristics, they'll flourish. And once we see what we're doing, then we actually have the choice. We move out of that ignorance into ideally a wisdom, a mindfulness and a wisdom.
So are you saying that all desire is bad, even if it's not with clinging or grasping?
No. No, you look at it, is it a wholesome desire or is it an unwholesome desire? You know, one of the best examples is the Buddha's desire to reach enlightenment, to be free from suffering. You know, that was a desire, a very strong desire. You know, he said he wasn't, yeah, he was going to sit under the Bodhi tree until he reached enlightenment.
Also, you had mentioned, I was confused, It seemed like you were saying that beauty was a negative thing. And was I misunderstanding that? If you experience or enjoy beauty, then you should start thinking about corpses and things that aren't beautiful, so you don't enjoy beauty?
No, that'd be a bummer. No, it's when we start getting into craving and grasping, is that beauty is beauty. And to be able to enjoy it is one of the greatest gifts. One of the ways that we corrupt beauty is by wanting to either possess it. When the clinging and grasping comes in, where it's like, it needs to be mine, you know, then we start losing perspective on that beauty. We can't enjoy it as much because we want to possess it. So it's about trying to, is the need to have that beauty as opposed to appreciating the beauty. If that makes sense. It's like, yeah, beauty is a good thing. Yeah.
You gave remedial practices for the first two, but what's the remedial practice for the confusion?
Sadly enough, it's walking meditation. Because what happens with the confused type is that they can easily get lost. So as I'm sitting here, this is definitely my story. It's like I would sit down and I'll start falling asleep. You know, that's a characteristic of the confused type. But walking meditation, it's a much more simple, and you know, you have subtle feelings and gross feelings. So the confused type needs simple, and the gross type, you know, the touching of the foot against the floor is something really tangible, whereas the breath here is very subtle. And so the subtle stuff, it's hard for the confused to keep the attention on that, but they can keep it much more easily on walking. And I sort of see it's keeping it simple also, so that, you know, at one time I got rid of most of the books that I was reading or in my library, because, you know, I just was having too much information. So let's keep with one practice and stick with that for a couple years. And if it's not working for me, then you know, with my teacher, reassess.
Mm-hmm. And can I meditate on that, or is that thinking?
Yes and yes. Mm-hmm. You can meditate on it, or in some ways just noting it. You know, if you start having a dialogue about craving, you know, you're doing, in some ways you're doing a reflection around it. So I don't know how to answer that actually. I don't know how to answer that right now. Okay, we have one more question, and then...
I just had a comment or a question. For me, it can be very helpful to reflect on things that I've done. Like if something bothered me, or if I, you know, I'm having a terrible day, to look back and look at things I did in the past. And to actually, reflect, okay, was I clinging? Was I grasping? What was going on? Was I jealous? Was I angry when I did it and I just didn't know it? For me, that actually really helps. Like, in a, in a meditative, you know, space, it helps me a lot. So. Like, yeah, I mean, it's like thinking when you're in a meditative, you know, state of mind. I don't know. It helps me. So.
You know, it can be both, and we're actually out of time. but thank you all. If you want to come up, and we can talk a little bit more about that. But thank you all, and blessings.